We are now in our second lesson on the Kalam argument. We're on page 287, 288, and we've looked at the very first argument for the beginning of the universe. You'll remember that the argument, the heart of the argument goes as follows. Whatever begins to exist needs a cause. The universe began to exist, and therefore the universe needs a cause. And we're looking at the second premise of that argument. And early on, I expanded the argument out into an overall argument for not just a beginning of the universe, but showing how it leads to God's existence. And so what we're doing is we're analyzing each of these premises, and we're at premise two, and I'm going to explain what I have on the board here in just a minute. But we're about to jump into deep territory, so have fun. In a way, the heart of the debate, at least from a philosophical perspective. So on page 288, I'm going to go ahead and reread what we looked at last week to sort of catch us up. An infinite temporal regressive event is an actual infinite. And you'll notice that the first premise of this argument was an actually infinite number of things cannot exist. Or actual infinities cannot exist. So we're actually giving a philosophical argument against the existence of the actual infinite. And we went through all kinds of thought experiments showing that actual infinities are metaphysically impossible. They're logically possible, but they just don't match up the world the way it is. And so premise two, or the second premise, premise B for that is an infinite temporal regressive events is an actual infinite. If the universe never had a beginning, then an infinite number of events have transpired up until the present moment. Indeed, if the universe is eternal, then if we were to take a time machine into the past, we could never witness a first moment of the universe's history. For every moment of time we reach, there's yet another prior moment before it, and one before that, and another before that, and so on ad infinitum. The question before us is this. Did the universe have an absolute beginning of its existence? If we say yes, then we've established a major premise of the Kalam argument. The universe began to exist. If we say no, then we must conclude that the universe is eternal, and hence the number of past moments in our universe's history is actually infinite. But we have already shown that actual infinities are impossible. Therefore, our cosmos cannot be eternal. It must have had a beginning. Now, at that point, we are automatically, immediately forced into a major objection to the argument, which is that this argument presupposes an A theory of time and not a B theory of time. And at that point, you have to say, well, what? What is that? What is the difference between the A and the B theory? Have you ever heard of this dispute, that there are two views of time? Okay. This is one of the most fascinating things you can ever study. And it's the heart of the argument. The Kalam argument does indeed presuppose the A theory of time. But you have to understand what the A and B theories are. So let's just begin to unpack this slowly. And if you skip the very opening paragraph of the objection, let me go ahead and just read the objection. I'm trying to catch up here with my own writing. There is one objection to our line of reasoning, namely that actual infinities cannot exist, and it goes like this. The argument we have just employed only works if the B theory of time is true. Now notice, I just said that the Kalam argument presupposes the A theory. It only works if the B theory of time is true, but it would appear that the A theory is true. Therefore, our argument for the beginning of the universe is invalid or unsound. Of course, this leads us to explore the distinction between the A theory of time and the B theory of time. So the question that we have to ask is this, is the flow of time we seem to experience an objective feature of reality? Is that real? Or is it just a byproduct of human consciousness? Atheists endorse what some philosophers of time call the tensed view of time, or the dynamic view of time, and thus believe that time is truly dynamic. And so the tense language humans employ in their daily lives, like, I will be at the grocery store in 1 hour. I am now at the grocery store. I was at the grocery store an hour ago, and so forth, reflects the way the world actually is. In short, the atheist's answer to our first question is in the affirmative, and his answer to the second question is in the negative. B-theorists endorse what some philosophers of time call the tenseless view of time, or the static view of time, and thus believe that despite what our consciousness may be telling us, time is really static. And so the tense language humans employ in their daily lives is simply a useful fiction.
So it's in a nutshell that there's no difference between past and present and where you are in either.
At the end of the day, there's really no difference between past and present. Okay, so this is what I did is I just did a circle. This is what's on the board, a circle, and in the middle of the circle is a ray. And if atheism is true, or if a theism that has an eternal universe is true, we looked at this with the Thomistic argument, then time is to be likened to a line and not a ray, right? Because time is eternal, right? So there was never a first moment.
This is the infinite.
Right? Yeah, this is the infinite. And if what we're arguing for is true, this is what time looks like. So you have a beginning point, so it's a ray, and then you extend it out. But here's the question. Are all moments in time currently existing? Or are they truly past? Okay, so, I drove up here. This morning, and you saw me. Well, is there a past for me to go back to? In other words, can I go back and see me driving up here?
Still, the house this morning getting ready, still there right now.
Right. Yeah, so the B theory time would say all past, present, and future moments all exist concurrently in one big block. The only difference is that at the moment that you're experiencing, that's the moment that consciousness is sort of lit up, as it were. So picture the B theory of time as a string with light bulbs on it, and you send an electric current through it, and the light bulbs blink in succession. Well, when the current passes through the first light bulb and goes to the second, the light bulb is still there. It's just that only one light bulb is being lit up at a time. Well, the moments are all still there. It's just that human consciousness is only lit up in what we consider to be the present moment. But the present moment is one of many moments that currently exists. Time travel...
I was about to say, physicists would love this if it were true, because they could time travel.
Time travel is in principle possible only on the B theory, because there is a past to travel to. So the A theory of time would... basically say they would split all of this up into distinct moments, right? And then when one moment comes into existence, the other moment fades away. So the only thing that really exists is the present moment. The future doesn't exist. The past doesn't exist. The only thing that truly exists is the moment.
But doesn't that get into...
The presentists, the atheists who really do embrace presentism, would say that in terms of space, all the matter that exists at the present moment, right? And there's a continuity between the past and the present, so that the matter does exist through moments. But the temporal moment itself, the event itself, is no longer real.
Right. I mean, every time our planet orbited, we'd hit ourselves every time we came around.
Right. So it's time that is constantly in flux and changing. Space is too, because space we're being told is expanding and all that stuff. And we're going to get into that. But those are the two views of time. Does that kind of capture?
It makes a little more sense.
Okay. Yeah, time travel is impossible on the A theory, because on the A theory there's nothing
to go back
to travel to.
Or
right.
Forward, and forward hasn't happened yet.
Forward hasn't happened. Okay.
Makes good movies, but.
Right. It makes great.
About time travel.
It makes for great movies, but it's not. It doesn't. It doesn't really correspond to what is real. So I'm going to just repeat myself in what I'm reading, because it's good to sort of hit it from different angles. According to atheists, the present moment is all there is. The past once existed, but is no more. The future will exist some time from now, but has yet to come into existence. Thus, time is arranged exactly how we seem to experience it, namely in accordance with earlier than, present with, and later than. With the first and last of these as literally non-existent, and the second as all there is. All that reality is exists in the present moment, exists in the now. B theorists see all of time as stretched out along a continuum, with the past, present, and future existing simultaneously. And so while we experience moments as earlier than, present with, and later than in reality, all those moments are simultaneous with one another. Thus, moments in time are not literally earlier than or later than other moments. Rather, moments are merely before and after. See, on a B theory, you can speak of befores and afters, but you can't speak of literally earlier than and later than, because they all exist simultaneously. Depending on where they appear on the arrow of time, they are before and after depending on where they appear on the arrow of time. And I give in here the illustration of the a string of light bulbs strung across the street being held up by two buildings, where each light bulb is lit sequentially, one at a time. Notice that as one light bulb is lit, it is not as though the other light bulbs do not exist. It's just that one is receiving the power or electricity while the others have already received it or are waiting to receive it. In a similar way, our history tells us that General Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon before his nephew Octavian became emperor, which in turn happened before Emperor Nero fiddled his harp over a burning Rome. But it's not as though Julius Caesar's famous crossing occurred earlier than Octavian's coronation, nor is it the case that Nero's music was played by the emperor later than Augustus Caesar became Rome's first emperor. No, it's just that his consciousness, and human consciousness in general, was lit up, as it were, with a sort of now perspective that saw his uncle's crossing as a past event. But in reality, all of these moments are simultaneous. We note in passing that everyone who thinks that time travel is possible must be a B theorist, for on this notion of time, there is a past and a future to which one can travel. On the A theory, the past and the future are not real. Thus, there is no time to which one can travel other than the present moment. Now, is there a way to establish one view of time over the other? And I think there is. And I've given William Lane Craig praise in the past, and I have to do it again. He's not only an expert on the Kalam argument, he's an expert on the whole issue of time. So he's got like four scholarly monographs out there just analyzing time. So the guy, he's just a workhorse. So he's produced a lot just in this area. And he wrote a popular book that you may be interested in, Time and Eternity. And it's in the footnote. It's written for a layman's perspective. It's written for a layman. And this is the argument that you can find in his book, Time and Eternity. Here's the argument in favor of the A theory. Premise one. The temporal becoming of mental events is either mind-dependent or it is not. If it is not, then temporal becoming is objective. If it is, then temporal becoming is objective. Therefore, temporal becoming is objective. Now remember, temporal becoming being objective just is the A theory, right? Because we really are passing from one moment to the next, and when the moments pass, they are past, and they don't exist, and the present is all there is, and the future still awaits us, and that is an objective feature of reality. So reality is how we seem to feel it, intuit it, and how we seem to be aware of it. So premise one is not to be interpreted as the obvious assertion that without minds there will be no mental events at all. That, again, is obvious. But is the phenomenon of temporal becoming mind-dependent in the sense that it is ultimately illusory or non-objective, as the B theorists would have it? Now, do you get that? So if temporal becoming is non-objective, that just is the B theory, because while I may be seeming to go through these moments, I'm not really going through really distinct moments. I mean, all that's happening is that I perceive reality to be truly changing, but really I'm just, my mind is just an electrode being sent through a light bulb, and there's another one waiting for me. So I basically am made up of just a bunch of temporal parts.
It sounds like these are a bunch of events just waiting to happen for you to arrive at.
Yes. Yeah, and so the temporal becoming is really just a feature of my consciousness. It's not a feature of what's really going on in the real world. That is the issue under consideration. Is that the case, that temporal becoming is illusory or objective? I say that is the issue under consideration, and the atheist can plausibly argue that regardless of how one answers this question, temporal becoming is an objective feature of reality, in which case the A theory is true. Indeed, if premise two is true, then temporal becoming is not illusory, and hence it is an objective feature of reality. Minds or no minds, the flow of time is real. If premise three is true, then one might think that the B theory would automatically follow. For in that case, temporal becoming is no longer an objective feature of reality, but merely a subjective one. However, such a conclusion would be hasty. Now remember, premise three says, if temporal becoming is mind-dependent, then temporal becoming is objective. And you would say, well, how could that be? Well, the conclusion that the B theory follows, given premise three, or at least the heart of premise three, is a hasty conclusion, for even if temporal becoming were mind-dependent, our consciousness of the flow of time is still real. Craig writes, the problem with the B theory is that it denies that we experience the becoming of our experiences. For if we do have such an experience, then we must ask all over again whether that experience is mind-dependent or not, and so on. To halt a vicious infinite regress, the static time theorist must deny that we do experience the becoming of experiences. But such a phenomenology is patently absurd. The so-called presentness of experience is a fundamental datum which the advocate of static time must account for. Even more fundamentally, however, the position that mental becoming is illusory is incoherent. Bluntly put, even the illusion of becoming implies becoming. Becoming cannot be mere illusion or appearance, because an illusion or appearance of becoming involves becoming. An idealist philosopher can consistently hold space to be illusory, for an illusion of space is not itself spatial, but an illusion of time is itself a temporal experience. A person who has supposedly illusory experience of becoming is experiencing the becoming of his experiences. and this experiencing is itself a flux of experience. Change cannot be wholly illusory, for the illusion of change is a changing illusion. Thus, the idea that temporal becoming is wholly illusory and unreal is self-refuting.
Well.
Now, if you want an analogy, picture... Picture the person who looks at you and says, you are not in pain, even though you feel that you are. The problem is that pain is one of those things that you can't have the illusion of, right? Because if you're in pain, you're in pain.
We have somatic pain.
You can maybe talk about the cause of the pain,
right,
or the origin of the pain, and that may be helping you come to a point where you no longer experience it. But the pain is real, no matter what its origin. Is it psychosomatic? Is it somatic? Whatever. The pain is real, regardless of how you understand its origin. Well, becoming is real. Becoming literally cannot be illusory, because even the illusion of it is an instance of becoming. Right? So total illusion of change, experience, befores and afters in accordance with a later than, earlier than, present with, and so forth, that all cannot be denied as a feature of your consciousness, and therefore it can't be an illusion. And therefore, since it can't be an illusion, the A theory of time must be true. The A theory of time is undeniable, since the alternative is self-defeating. Indeed, a static view of time, wherein all moments of the universe's history, past, present, and future, exist simultaneously, renders time timeless, and that seems to be incoherent.
Probably sums it up best.
I mean, does it really make sense to say that while we're having this conversation, Caesar's crossing the Rubicon and Hitler's getting rejected from art school?
No.
It just doesn't make sense to speak that way. And therefore, those moments did really happen,
right,
but they are no longer real.
And not still happening.
They're not still happening.
They're not unreal, being played over and over and over,
right,
again, just waiting for us to
go back and observe, right. But here's the consequence that some people would say. They would say, okay, fine, the A theory is true. The A theory of time is true. If that's the case, then our philosophical argument for the finitude of the past is unsound, for it can only be sound if the B theory of time is true. Indeed, on the B theory, the past, present, and future exist at once. And so one could feasibly argue that if there is no edge to time, if time is to be conceived of as a line rather than a ray, and I put that in the footnote, if there is no beginning, then the number of moments on the timeline is actually infinite. But actual infinities cannot exist. Therefore, there is an edge to time. That is, there is a beginning of the timeline, or time ray, as it were, and hence the cosmos began to exist. So far, so good. However, we have just shown that the A theory is true, in which case the arguments against the existence of an actual infinite do not apply. For the only moment that exists is the present. Hence, there is no number, finite or infinite, of past moments. There is just the present moment, a moment of time which is constantly slipping into the future, therefore thereby becoming a part of the past, which is no longer existent and hence not a part of the number of moments. In short, the A theory renders this proof irrelevant. Do you get that argument?
I think so.
All right, so You have your timeline.
I think I understand the A argument better than I understand
this objection.
Yeah.
Okay, so what the argument is basically this. If you're a B theorist, then this is a great argument showing that the universe had a beginning, because what you've shown is that there's an edge to the timeline. The timeline is a timeline, or better said, it is a ray. It has an origin point. But if you're a B theorist, then you would say all of these moments from here on exist all at once, right? So God just brought into existence the universe, if you want to go that route, and say he brought into existence the universe, and he brought in the whole universe, and all of time is just laid out before him. So God is like the guy watching the parade from a cliff, and he sees all these moments at once. And the actual infinity does not exist in this case because it all has a beginning point. Right?
Right. And that's
so that's not an actual infinite. It is at best a potential infinity. But since we've only... Since we have proven that the A theory is true, the only thing that exists is just this present moment. All right, so then why not say that an actual infinite number of moments have happened, but that doesn't mean that they currently exist? All those arguments that we just gave against the actual infinity would presuppose that the moments have to exist simultaneously. And the atheist would say, you're exactly right. The actual infinities cannot exist. But since I'm an atheist, that doesn't mean that I have to believe that the universe began to exist. An actual infinite number of moments have transpired, but none of them currently exist.
Well, if you were a B theorist, I mean, I go back to the clock example.
Right.
I did a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
You know, you take another step, but there's another origin.
Right.
It's infinite, and you're never going to get there.
Right. So a B theorist, this argument against the actual infinity applies to the B theorists. So if you hold to a B theory of time, this would be devastating to you if you thought that time never had a beginning, right?
Sure.
But if you're an A theorist, this argument against an actual infinity is irrelevant, because you could say it's not like Hilbert's hotel, where an actual infinite number of people are existing in the hotel all at once. It's just that before this moment, which is the only thing that exists, another moment existed in the past, and this moment did not exist. So the atheist says, yeah, actual infinities can't exist, and an actual infinity has never existed, because the only thing that's ever existed is the present moment. That's all that exists, right? And therefore, we could have had an actually infinite number of moments happen, but there's nothing wrong with saying that an actual infinite number of moments have happened. As long as they no longer exist, we're fine. And therefore, the universe could be eternal if the A theory of time is true. That's the objection to this argument.
I understand.
Okay, are we clear?
I think so.
I got to make sure you're clear on the objection before we go through the answer to it. Thoughts?
Well, if I were to maybe just simplify it down, the A theory,
okay,
is that we exist in the moment,
mm-hmm,
that we're presently in.
Mm-hmm.
The past has happened, it's gone, the future hasn't happened yet.
Right.
And in the A theory of time, we have a beginning.
On the A theory of time, what's being objected here is on the A theory of time, we may not have had a beginning because there's been no proof for an origin of the universe yet,
okay,
on the A theory.
Both theories then.
If we were B theorists, then we would have a proof for an origin of the universe, because we would show that since actual infinities cannot exist, the timeline must be a ray rather than a line. The timeline must have an edge to it. On the B theory, to keep us from saying that there are an actually infinite number of moments.
We're in a little bit of both then.
Well, what I'm saying is that since we've disproven the B theory,
right,
and all that's left is the A theory, we still yet to have an argument for an origin of the universe.
Okay, so
because actual infinities, yeah, they cannot exist. But on the A theory, who said that actual infinities exist? The only thing that exists is a moment. So you could argue that an actually infinite number of moments have transpired, but since they don't currently exist, what's the problem?
So the possibility.
The possibility of the universe being eternal on the A theory still stands. And since we've proven the A theory and we've debunked the B theory,
now you have to deal with that
objection. You have to deal with that objection. You have to say, well, how does this argument prove and origin of the universe on the A theory.
And that's where we're at.
That's where we're at right now.
Okay.
That's so you have to go down this tangent on A and B theory before you can understand like this objection, this sort of. By the way, when you're out on the street sharing, this is not going to come up. You're not going to run into most people are not going to go, well, your argument works if you're an A theorist, you know, if you're a B theorist. Yeah. But this is, you know, the point is that we're trying to get ourselves ready to defend God's existence to anybody that we encounter. Obviously, if we encounter someone, and incidentally, I've always said this to students, if you're giving an argument for God's existence and you've worked through all the objections and you can, with a clear conscience, offer that argument to somebody, don't ever ask them to fight back if they say, oh, yeah. So if you give, let's say we give this argument against actual infinities, right? And they don't raise the point about the BNA theory. We shouldn't say, yeah, we should say, well, good, I'm glad you accept this argument for an origin of the universe. And getting into the A and B theory stuff is really just a tangent and may confuse them. So you master this argument against actual infinities existing and show how if the universe didn't have a beginning and actually infinite number of moments have transpired, and therefore the universe must have had a beginning because actual infinities can't exist. End of story. But what if they say, hey, look, I take philosophy and my professor explained to us the difference between the tensed and tenseless view of time or the A and B theory. So how do you overcome this objection? We have to be ready to overcome that objection. So let's look through how I would answer such a thing. So the question is, how on an A theory does this argument against actual infinities, how does it work? Or how can you say that actual infinities cannot exist on the A theory? We endorse the A theory of time and thus insist that the present is the only moment that is real. Nevertheless, we presentists can accurately count events and things that no longer exist. We can count the number of U.S. presidents, despite the fact that most are dead. We can count the number of Roman emperors who reigned during the Pax Romana, even though all of them are dead. We can count the number of years the United States has been a nation, the number of years we have been exploring space, the years of our children and parents, and the number of years between now and the defeat of the Spanish Armada. We can do all of these things even though the past is not real. It is simply not true to insist that non-existent things or events cannot be enumerated. So any beginningless series of events of equal duration, for example, a beginningless series of years or months or weeks or days or hours or minutes or seconds and so forth, will consist of an infinite number of events since it is larger than any natural number. Thus, we can imagine a carpenter who never began hammering an anvil, and over time he has worn out the tool and destroyed it, only to pick up another hammer to renew his work. Since he never began this process, the carpenter has been working for a beginningless eternity and has thus worn out an infinite number of hammers. That these tools no longer exist does not change the fact that their number is infinite. Likewise, that no past event of a beginningless timeline currently exists does not change the fact that the number of past events is actually infinite. Therefore, the A theory of time does not refute our first philosophical argument. Okay, I'm going to let you pause there and kind of soak that in. So even though we believe in the A theory, that doesn't make this argument against actual infinities irrelevant to the A theory, because events can be counted. And if the universe is eternal, the number of past moments is currently infinite, just as if the process of presidents being elected had never had a beginning, our current number of presidents would be infinite.
I was about to say, it seems like it would give you a problem because the only way to be able to count and measure it is the past events.
Right.
You can't measure what hasn't happened yet.
Exactly. I mean, are all the presidents that have ever served in our country, are they still around?
No.
But it certainly makes sense for us to say that there have been 40, there are 45 presidents in the United States history.
Yes.
That number is currently 45. There are 45 presidents in our history. Okay, I can give a tenseless statement to the effect that there are...
Well, you qualified it, though, with history.
Sure. But I would say, I could say that there are there is an infinite number of moments in our universe's history. That makes sense on an A theory of time just as much as it makes sense on a B theory. So the question now is, well, could such a thing exist? Could an actually infinite number of moments exist?
We have to establish the beginning.
Well, I think this does establish the beginning. If you say, no, actual infinities can't exist, that applies to the A theory just as much as it applies to the B theory. It doesn't make sense on an A theory, even on an A theory, to say an infinite number of moments exist.
So the A theory, even though we don't agree with it.
We do agree with the A theory.
I mean, we do agree with the A theory, but we don't agree with an infinite universe in the A theory. But
yeah.
Trying to say we accept the possibility, but in a B theory, it can only be infinite.
On a B theory, let's say that you and I just adopted the B theory, then this entire excursus would be unnecessary. Because on the B theory, all moments exist at once.
Right.
Okay? And since we've established that actual infinities can't exist, then we have to conclude that the universe had a beginning. Because on the B theory, all moments would exist at once, and therefore, if the universe never had a beginning, then an actually infinite number of moments would exist simultaneously. I would be speaking these words to you. Jesus would be crucified. Caesar would be crossing the Rubicon. You know, Pharaoh would be saying, "Go kill the Israelites." You know. Put them in slavery, kill all the firstborn. He would be saying those things. All these things would be going on at once, and an infinite number of such events would be going on at once. So if you're a B theorist and you hear this argument against actual infinities existing, as a B theorist, you say, well, wait a minute, then I guess there must be an edge to the line. There must be an edge to time. And therefore, even though all events exist simultaneously, there's not an infinite number of them. See, if you're a B theorist, you have to say that the universe had a beginning. So here, imagine.
Well, I had that backwards then, really.
Yeah. So the argument really does work on a B theory, and so here's where the atheist might look at me and smile and say, "Well, thank goodness I'm an A theorist because I don't have to worry about the argument against an actual infinite on an A theory of time because the only thing that exists is the present moment." To which I respond, yeah, but you can count, can't you? You can count past events. And if the number of moments in our universe's history is actually infinite, that could be true on an A theory just as much as a B theory. So the argument does really work on an A theory as well. So in other words, this argument against the actual infinite non-existing, I'll repeat myself, this argument against an actual infinity non-existing. I'll repeat it one more time because I misstated it. This argument against an actual infinite existing, it's against it existing, works whether you're a B theorist or an A theorist. Now, I'm an A theorist. And that's why I have to handle this argument. It's real easy to handle this issue on a B theory because it's obvious that an actual infinity can't exist, and therefore it's obvious that there must be an edge to time. You know, there's an edge.
Right. And that edge is...
the beginning point.
Zero.
Yeah. That edge is the beginning point.
Okay.
On the B theory, you would imagine that God just, poof, brought all moments into existence simultaneously. On the A theory, He brought the universe into existence. And then basically he sustained the universe in such a way that as you move into the future, the past fades away.
I have a feeling that when we start talking about multiverses, B-theory is going to come back.
Well, it turns out that a lot of your physicists are B-theorists. Like Einstein was a B-theorist. He, when a friend died, Einstein wrote the family, and he said, he's still with us, he's just in the past. So Einstein actually thought there was a past to travel to, and therefore he was, for all intents and purposes, a B-theorist.
Well, the A-theorist believes there's a past, too. They just, believe
they just don't think that there's there to travel to. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's
So I would say a dead person, assuming that there's no afterlife, right? If I didn't believe in an afterlife, I would say the person who has died is no longer real. They were real,
right?
But they just simply do not exist anymore.
And they don't exist in the past.
They don't exist in the past because the past isn't
like
real.
Anything else, there's a history.
Yeah. So they were real, but they are not real. On a B theory, they were real, and because they were real, they are real.
Did you, I'll go off for a second. This might not make sense. I know you're probably a Star Trek guy like me, too.
I am.
You remember Generations?
Yeah, the movie Generations is a really interesting movie because it's a movie about escaping our death, and it's basically saying...
You can go back to any moment in time.
You can go back to any moment in time. Generations is a B-theory movie.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking when I was replaying that in my head. You know, when I first heard this movie was coming out, I said, how in the world are they going to put William Shatner and the cast from The Next Generation
together?
You know, how are they going to make that work? I was thinking the same thing about X-Men Days of Future Past. You know?
Sure. All of those movies are B-theory movies.
That's probably how I would present the argument to somebody.
Right. Well, yeah. There are all kinds of analogies you can give. Yeah. But yeah, they're all B-theory. And here's an interesting... It's interesting you bring that up. This is fascinating. You'll remember the scene when Jean-Luc Picard and Captain Kirk are on horseback.
Right.
And Captain Kirk jumps this ravine, and he comes back, and he says, I've jumped this 100 times when I was a kid, and I was scared every time, and I wasn't afraid this time. He goes, this isn't real. And I want to say, well, if the B theory of time is true, none of it is really real. It's all an illusion.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things, what I like about the A theory is that it really does tap into our own intuitions as to how reality works. And that's why I cling to it. It just is saying what you think is the case is the case. And I never want to let go of those intuitions unless I'm given really strong reason to do so. Anything else about A and B theory?
No, I think I've got it. I just... A lot of... Maybe the language around it is what...
Sure. It's tough jargon. I mean, I've talked to seminary professors. When I was getting my master's degree, there was a professor of mine who thanked me when I wrote a paper because he goes, I never really understood that. You know, you hear about it.
Right.
But you're like, it's not your area of study. And so they would say, well, thank you for explaining this to me because I hear this bandied about every now and then. And I don't know, when Wayne Grudem wrote his Systematic Theology, he clearly presupposed the B theory, and Craig wrote a scathing review of his Systematic Theology, basically just showing he didn't appreciate the debate there. And Grudem, in response, said, I'll be honest, I had never heard of any of this, because he just wasn't trained in philosophy. And this is...
Well, it's where science and where physics and philosophy, I think, are colliding.
Yeah. Exactly, you're exactly right. And you'll. This is not a, by the way, a theist, atheist, pantheist thing. Although I would have a hard time imagining a pantheist being an atheist. It seems to me that if pantheism is true, you have to be a b-theorist, and therefore
you believe in everything.
Right. In fact, our argument against pantheism earlier, if you've gone through those lectures, if you think about it, it really is basically just an argument, the same argument for the A theory of time, just as the argument against pantheism. Because I would look at a pantheist and say, well, when did you come to realize you were God? And the moment they give an answer, then I have a proof against pantheism, because the act of coming to realize something is a real genuine change in you, and therefore it's proof that you are not this infinite necessary being that pantheists postulate. So you can't be God.
I see a rude awakening.
Sure.
Down the road.
Oh yeah. Imagine when the veil of this so-called illusion is drawn back, and you actually confront the real. It can be quite sobering. So here's the conclusion. Therefore, an infinite temporal regressive events cannot exist. This follows logically from the first two premises. If actual infinities cannot exist, and if an infinite temporal regressive past events is an actual infinite, then an infinite temporal regressive past events cannot exist. But this would entail that the number of past events is finite, therefore the universe had a beginning. Now, you'll notice something else with this. You were with us when we looked at the Thomistic argument?
I was not.
Okay, well,
I heard a little bit of
on the Thomistic argument, we argued this way.
Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, this is Thomas Aquinas' argument. And Thomas's argument presupposes that the universe never had a beginning. Thomas himself believed that the universe did have a beginning, but he did because the Bible told him so. But he didn't think you could prove to anybody that the universe had a beginning. We're in the process of trying to prove that. Now, Aquinas argued that right now, as we speak, I am a contingent being. Okay? And as a contingent being, I'm dependent upon another contingent being, which is dependent upon another and another and another. And I asked this question. Let's assume that the number of contingent things is finite. I said this when we were talking about this proof. Well, that would mean that if it is finite, then at some point it stops, and there's an uncaused, non-contingent being sustaining the series of contingent things. And I said at the time, but that's too easy. Let's assume that the number is infinite. And we went through all the issues of whether, you know, assuming that the number of contingent things is infinite, would that infinite series of contingent things need a cause?
The contingent things, or is that referring to genealogy?
Well, the contingent things referring to the causes that currently sustain you. So what Thomas is arguing for is not a creator of the universe, even though he used that language. He spoke of eternal creation, which I find somewhat incoherent. He really was talking about eternal sustaining. So God is not the creator of the universe on Thomas's argument so much as God is the sustainer of the universe. He's the one that keeps the universe in being currently as we speak.
He suggests that it always existed and that God just maintains it.
Yeah. Now, he doesn't believe that, but he's saying even if I had to conclude that the universe has always existed, I still have to have an accounting for my current existence as a contingent thing. Right now, as we speak, I need a cause. And that cause is, for example, oxygen. Well, what's the cause of oxygen? And you can just draw that back. So the question is, are the number of contingent things infinite or finite? And I did go through the whole reasoning of even if we assumed an infinite number of currently existing contingent things, you still have to have an uncaused cause. So I played with that possibility. But now notice something. We've actually strengthened the Thomistic argument with this argument because we've proven that actual infinities cannot exist. And therefore, the number of contingent things must end in an uncaused cause. So you can see how these arguments can kind of actually reinforce each other. Because we do grant that an infinite number of things is possible, but now that we know that they're metaphysically impossible, they're logically possible, but metaphysically impossible, we know that the Thomistic argument has now been strengthened even more. There's even more reason now to think that Thomas got it right.
Let me ask you this.
These arguments reinforce each other because the Bible says that in God all things hold together. So right now as we speak, we need a preservative cause of the universe. That's what Scripture teaches, and that's what Thomas's proof gives us. The Kalam argument says, not only so, the sum total of contingent things had an absolute origin. They all came into existence at one point. So God is not only the creator of the universe out of nothing, but he is the current sustainer of the universe.
If something has a cause,
yes,
that absolutely means there's going to be an end to it. I don't think we can have past infinities. You know, and certainly not in what we're talking about here, but
sure.
You know, to us,
the future is potentially infinite.
Okay, that was my question.
Right. And because of God's guarantee, now we don't get this from natural theology, but Scripture says that God has guaranteed a future for us. So it's a potential infinity, and it's a guaranteed infinity given God's promise. But metaphysically and all of that, God could, if he wants, he could take his hands off of the universe. I'm speaking metaphorically because God doesn't literally have hands. But he could take his hands off the universe and the universe would perish into oblivion. So moment by moment by moment, you're depending on God for your existence. And the Thomistic argument is really my favorite argument because it gives the atheists everything that they could possibly want in terms of a starting point and still shows that God exists. But this is also a fun argument because it's taking away that fundamental starting point. The atheist wants an eternal universe, and we're saying you can't have that given the impossibility, the metaphysical impossibility of actual infinities existing.
Well, and I think, I told you last time, the reason I like the Kalam argument, the mm-hmm. scientific approach, is because mm-hmm. I think that's the source of your average person's doubt.
Right. And unfortunately, we haven't even gotten into the science yet. We're still doing the philosophy. But let's go ahead and do the second philosophical argument. And the second philosophical argument is really interesting, and it goes like this. Even if an actually infinite number of things could exist, and that could is metaphysical, even if an actually infinite number of things could exist, it would be impossible to form such an actual infinite through successive addition. Let's assume that nearly every statement we have given about the actual infinite is false. That is, let us assume that actual infinities are metaphysically possible. Even so, there is yet another philosophical argument for the finitude of the past which does not presuppose the impossibility of the infinite. And the argument can be outlined as follows. Now, when I'm out on the street, this is the one I give. Okay. The reason I do is because I don't have to get into a theory and B theory at all. I don't have to worry about that objection. I don't have to worry about them understanding a concept of the actual infinite and all of that. I have it in my quiver, right?
If I run into the
personally tenacious and philosophically erudite atheist, but I don't usually use it. It's not my first go. It is my first go, though, when I talk about the origin of the universe, because this is a really... It's always been an intriguing argument to me, and it's a really powerful one. And so I give it. To me, it's very persuasive and very sound. Here's the argument. A collection formed by successive addition cannot be an actual infinite. The next premise is the temporal series of events is a collection formed by successive addition, and therefore the temporal series of events cannot be an actual infinite. Once again, we have before us a valid argument, and so we have to just look at the premises to see if they're sound. So what about that first premise? A collection formed by successive addition cannot be an actual infinite. By successive addition, one means the accrual of one new element at a later time.
It's our RA argument.
That's right.
RA theory.
Yeah. So... at each moment, I'm adding moments to the present moment.
The presidents.
One president is being added to another as time goes on. Trump is just the newest addition in a series of additions of presidents.
But only one of them is president at a time.
And only one is president at a time. Very good. Now, it seems obvious that as per our definition of the actual infinite, a completed totality cannot be formed through successive addition. Remember, that's how we define the infinite. When J.P. Moreland gave those characteristics of the infinite, I'm going to reread what he says. This is on page 276. Moreland says, first, an actual infinity is a timeless totality which neither increases nor decreases in the number of members it contains. Second, a proper subset or part of an actual infinite can be put in one-to-one correspondence with or be made equal to the actual infinite, and this contrasts with the finite set where the whole is always greater than the number of its parts. In addition, one can add or subtract many members from an actual infinite set and not change the number of members of the set. Okay? So anything that is formed by successive addition is not an actual infinite. Okay? Now this argument, I said earlier, I have to take it back. I said earlier that we don't have to get into A and B theory. Not that I would out on the street, but this really does presuppose an A theory of time. This is why Craig says the Kalam argument is the A theory through and through. It just presupposes that totally. Now, if one begins counting, one will never make it to infinity. If you start the counting process, you're never going to reach infinity. Or no matter how many steps one takes, the addition of one more step will not bring one to a point infinitely distant from one starting point.
The clock.
The clock. Very good. To be sure, those who disagree with our argument will insist that we have misunderstood the issues involved in the whole debate. For it is not the case that anyone is trying to defend the idea that one can reach infinity by beginning at a point in time and moving forward. That is, no one can ever count to infinity. On the other hand, one could count from infinity, says those who argue against us, and then end at a point after adding one member to another from eternity. However, and this is my response to such a claim, we don't see how this move will save the critic of the Kalam argument from incoherence. For counting from infinity seems just as difficult as counting to infinity. Imagine a very old man who has been counting to zero from negative infinity. Will he ever reach zero? Could this person ever find himself after counting forever? That is, he never began counting, but he has been doing so from eternity, saying -3, -2, -1, 0. I don't think so. For an infinite temporal distance originally existed between him and the number zero. How could he have traversed the infinite to reach zero? How could he traverse the infinite to reach any number? Indeed, if there ever was a day when we discovered him reaching zero, we could always ask, why didn't you reach zero yesterday, or the day before that, or even the day before that? After all, you had an eternity to reach your destination.
He was going the other way.
Yeah.
If it's infinitely negative and zero is here,
yeah,
he's moving this way.
Right.
I mean, you can.
Yeah, that's another way to look at it, yeah. So you simply cannot you cannot traverse the infinite, and because you cannot do that, you have to say that the number of temporal events is finite.
You have to start somewhere, and you can't start, it seems, maybe I'm misinterpreting a little, but you can't start without a starting point.
That's right. You can't start without a starting point.
Yeah, if it's infinitely negative, where on the line do you start counting from?
Exactly right.
You have to choose a starting point.
So, here's what Craig and Sinclair say. Craig and Sinclair argue, if one cannot traverse the infinite by moving in one direction, how can one traverse it by moving in the opposite direction? In order for us to have arrived at today, temporal existence has, so to speak, traversed an infinite number of prior events. And before the present event could occur, the event immediately prior to it would have to occur. And before that event could occur, the event immediately prior to it would have to occur, and so on, ad infinitum. One gets driven back and back into the infinite past, making it impossible for any event to occur. Thus, if the series of past events were beginningless, the present event could not have occurred, which is absurd. It is unavailing to say that an infinite series of past events cannot be formed only in a finite time, but that such a formation is possible given infinite time, for that riposte only pushes the question back a notch. How can an actually infinite series of congruent temporal intervals successively elapse? Tenseless correlations are irrelevant here. Now, I'm going to go ahead and just go to the footnote and explain what they just said. In other words, some try to appeal to a B theory of time in order to overcome this argument. If the B theory were true, then one could say that all events in time exist simultaneously, and so the problem of forming the infinite through successive addition is avoided. However, A, we should remember that the B theorists must now face the metaphysical problems entailed by affirming the existence of an actually infinite multitude. That's still a problem for him. And B, besides, the A theory is far more plausible than the B theory. And given that, you can't just appeal to the B theory to get out of this jam.
Solve that one little problem.
Right. Granted that the series of past events, if infinite, can be mapped one-to-one in an equally infinite series of past temporal intervals, the question remains how such a temporal series can be lived through so as to arrive at the present moment. And what they're getting at is that, by the way, Craig has been asked on his website if you could come up with an argument, a Kalam argument, that presupposes the B theory. And this line here has caused people to think that maybe you could. Now, that would strengthen the Kalam argument. That would make it even better because regardless of what theory of time you appeal to, you have to believe that God exists. You have to believe that the universe had a beginning. And what I'm getting at here is, he says, tenseless correlations are irrelevant here. Granted that the series of past events, if infinite, can be mapped one-to-one onto an equally infinite series of past temporal intervals, the question remains how such a temporal series can be lived through so as to arrive at the present. So imagine that you're on this timeline, and it's an infinite past, okay? You never had a beginning. And let's just say it all exists at once, right? And here you are, somewhere in the past, and you're wanting to live through the moment. The question is, can you? Can you arrive at this moment, even on a B theory? And it seems to me that you might not be able to, because there is an actually infinite distance between you and that moment. And therefore, could you ever traverse the moment, even on a B theory? And so that's the question that's being raised there. And Craig says, I don't even think so. So some people have seen in that line a very possible way of arguing against an eternal universe on the B theory. And again, that would only strengthen the argument. But let's just set that aside. We've already defended the A theory, and it's clear that on the A theory, moments are being added to moments through successive addition, and we know that that's impossible if you're talking about an actual infinite, that's an impossibility. Actual infinities cannot be added to in that way, and therefore the number of past moments has to be finite. All right, questions?
No, I think I'm with you.
Well, on page 295, we have some objections. In fact, we have two objections that we're going to look at. The first objection is this. Actual infinities can be traversed in the real world. J.L. Mackey tells us that the defender of the Kalam argument is actually assuming that even if past time were infinite, there would still have been a starting point in time, but one infinitely remote, so that an actual infinity would have had to be traversed to reach the present from there. In order to take the idea of infinity seriously, however, one should suppose that there was no starting point, not even an infinitely remote one, and that from any specific point in past time, there's only a finite stretch that needs to be traversed to reach the present. Quentin Smith has offered a similar criticism accompanied with an illustration. He writes, if past events are infinitely numerous, then they form a set that is open to one end and closed on the other, the present event being the closure. He offers the following illustration with each negative number corresponding to each past event. So imagine you have an infinite number of negative numbers, and you go negative 4 all the way down to negative 4, 3, 2, 1, and the present event is 0. Now he says, suppose we take the number negative 128, then there are negative 127 numbers, 127 numbers, between it and 0. Suppose we take a trillion times negative 128, then there still is some finite number between it and 0, and so on for any other number in this set. And yet, there is not a finite but an infinite number of negative numbers in this set. Before each negative number, there is another negative number. Now, my response is this. It is not the defender of the Kalam argument that fails to take the notion of infinity seriously, but the critic. Notice that once Mackey asks us to take the notion seriously, he then postulates that one can pick any point in the infinite past, and from there, a finite distance exists between a point in the past and the present. But neither Mackey's assertion nor Smith's illustration solves the difficulty. Indeed, they actually bolster the point of the argument, for their contention simply asks us to pick a point on the infinite timeline that is only a finite distance away. Yeah, you've made it finite by arbitrarily picking a point on the timeline to move forward. And they demonstrate in doing that just how impossible it is to traverse the infinite. I mean, I don't transcend this timeline, by the way. And therefore, if there really is an actual infinite distance between me and any other moment, then I can't get to that moment. Now, if I were God, I could just stand outside and pick a point and move forward, but then that would just destroy the point of their own perception or their own perspective.
Yeah, they have to acknowledge the existence of God.
Right, and so that's not going to work for them. This, however, is not the question anyone is answering. In other words, we're not asking whether you can arbitrarily pick a finite distance between any two points and traverse it. Obviously, you can. The defender of the Kalam argument is instead trying to discover how anyone can reach the present from an infinite past, not just a very distant one. The conclusion is that it is impossible to do so, and hence one must conclude that the past is finite. All right, so that seems to be a softball objection. But there's another objection that seems a little bit more curious. The Kalam argument, says some, fails to distinguish between counting and traversing moments. Again, we have Sarabji to thank for this. According to him, the Kalam argument turns on the comparison between counting and traversing a series. This, however, is a bad comparison. Counting differs from traversing in at least one respect, namely, when a person counts, he presumes a starting point. Traversing does not presume a starting point, hence, one cannot count through an infinite series, but one can traverse an infinite series. And then I give J.P. Moreland's response, which I think is sufficient. He says, first, Max Black has shown that the criticisms against traversing an actual infinite have nothing to do with counting. Counting is merely an act with a starting and a finish, and thus traversing an infinite number of counts or any other kind of events would be subject to the same criticisms. These criticisms are based on the nature of the actual infinite, not on the nature of counting. Second, the main point of the comparison between counting and traversing is not that one has a starting point and the other does not. Rather, both involve the successive formation of a series. Third, do you know what he means by that? What he's getting at there is the successive formation of the series only works if you're talking about a finite series.
It has to have a beginning and an end.
An actual infinite is fully formed, and therefore to speak of a successive formation of an infinite series doesn't make sense. So the nature of the actual infinite is such that it cannot be built up that way. And therefore, we know through experience that the present is being added to the past. And therefore, it doesn't make sense to speak of the past as being infinite. Because infinities cannot be added to. That's the whole point of an infinite.
I think it's fair to say that the past ends at the present.
Right. The past ends at the present. And therefore, the past is finite. Third, his third point is, if traversing an infinite differs from counting through an infinite in that the former has no starting point, but the latter has one, this makes traversing an infinite even worse than counting through it. It does not make the situation better. In order to see this, consider the following. Sarabji seems to be claiming that one cannot count from one to infinity because such a series has a starting point in the number one, but one can traverse an infinite series because it has no beginning. But does it help one to count to positive infinity if, instead of starting at one, he is told he must count from a beginningless negative infinity? How does this help? Using the word traverse instead of count cannot cover up the problem. In the latter case, one could not even reach the number one, much less positive infinity. In summary, then, just as it's impossible to write down every negative number ending with negative one, so also it is impossible to form an actual infinite through successive addition. Again, since actual infinities are by definition completed totalities, wherein the part is equal to the whole, our first premise should be obvious. Hence, we move forward to our second premise, namely, B, the temporal series of events is a collection formed by successive addition. This premise seems true enough. Every moment that occurs in our world is being added to each second by yet another event. Thus, if one wants to divide the number of events that occur into days, and you could do this any way you want, seconds, days, whatever, he will notice that each day is immediately succeeded by another day. Hence, the total number of days that transpire in the universe is formed through successive addition. To be sure, this premise presupposes the A theory of time. However, since we have already provided warrant for that presupposition, we see no reason to reject the premise. Therefore, the temporal series of events cannot be an actual infinite. This conclusion logically follows from A and B. If it is impossible to form an actual infinite through successive addition, and if the temporal series of events is a collection formed through successive addition, then it follows logically and inescapably that the temporal series of events which have occurred in the universe's history is finite. In short, the universe had a beginning. QED. All right. You and I are going to note the transition from philosophy to science here. And then I think that that would be a good place for us to end. But before I even get into that, do you have any questions about these philosophical arguments?
No, I think I need to go back and read them some more.
Sure. Soak them in and maybe the, you
I
know,
think
our,
I've got the overview.
The second one is easier to grasp than the first one. So we're going from hard to easy on in the order presentation. But the second one is, you know, I very quickly throw it out like this. Somebody might say, well, why do you think God exists? And I'll say, well, would you agree with me that if the universe began to exist, it would have to have a cause? Well, the common person on the street will say, well, of course. But then they'll say, well, how do you know the universe began to exist? And I usually say, well, imagine a man counting to zero from negative infinity. Is he going to reach zero? And most people think about it for a few seconds and are like, well, of course not.
I think when they hear that, they're
right. But you know, you can, and then you can give the illustration of, well, imagine him getting to zero. You could say, well, why did you get there today? You had an eternity to do so. And I would say this illustrates how impossible it is for one to traverse the infinite. But if the universe never had a beginning, we would have had to traverse an infinite number of moments to get to the present moment. In other words, if the universe is infinite, it would have been impossible to reach the present moment. But the present moment has been reached. Here we are having this discussion. Therefore, the universe has to be finite in terms of its time. It has to be temporally finite. It has to have a beginning. And at that point, they're like, whoa, I've never even thought about that before. Well, that they're sold at that point. And so I think it's a very easy, quick argument to give for an origin of the universe. I think the other one about the actual infinities is just not one that you might want to share on the street.
No, I don't think very many people.
But having it in your quiver is a good thing to have. You know, it's a good, I mean, it's a sound argument, and any sound argument, it's like the ontological argument I think is sound, and so I use it in a setting like this. But it's not my go-to argument on the street because it just is very abstract.
Generally, when I'm talking with somebody about the origins of the universe, and I don't know if anybody even considers it being infinite versus finite, but you throw out the Big Bang theory,
right?
People immediately recognize that. So I just
To
your average person, I'll say, well, do you believe?
Well, I usually do that. Yeah, I mean, if the conversation is only going to be a few seconds, I usually just cite the science myself, and that's what we're getting into. So, this is the transition. Therefore, the Kalam argument serves as the transition from arguments for God that are just purely philosophical to arguments for God that utilize the natural sciences. And we always have to be careful here. There is no scientific proof for God's existence. However, there are philosophical arguments for God's existence that utilize science in their premises to show that God exists. I mean, the existence of God is not a scientific question in the sense that you cannot use the tools of science to discover God. I would even argue that the science itself presupposes God, but that's a different issue that we've already addressed in the past.
I think it would definitely presuppose a creator.
Sure. Sure. But I will say that I think this is a very strong series of arguments we're about to give. And they're a little bit better and more persuasive to people in our culture because, as you said, most people in our culture will say science is really the reigning paradigm for rationality. I think we as theists, Christian theists to be more particular, should be excited about what's being discovered in science every day, because I think it just confirms more and more what we believe. And I think that what most Christians need to do, especially when you get into the Big Bang theory, is they really need to open themselves up to alternative interpretations of Genesis, because what's keeping the conservative Christians especially held back on clutching into this kind of argumentation is the fear of the billions of years and that sort of thing.
Right.
And I think that...
creation.
I'm sorry? Yeah. Six consecutive 24-hour days. God must have made the world in that way. And I think that once you just open yourself up to alternative interpretations, this becomes a powerful apologetic tool for God's existence. I will say that a young earth creationist cannot use the material we're about to get into. They can use the material that we just covered in philosophy. So a young earth creationist could use the philosophical arguments because those arguments do not in any way, shape, or form presuppose...
You mean as it's written in Genesis?
Well, not just as it's written in Genesis, but as it's interpreted by them as being six consecutive 24-hour time periods. Those individuals cannot use... with a clear conscience, this material we're about to get into, because this material argues very strongly in favor of a universe that's billions of years old. Now, you can use this material in the following way, in an attempt to clear your conscience. You could say, even if I used your time scales, these would be the implications and all of that stuff. But that puts the atheist in a precarious position, because if he follows the young earth creationist argument, he has to then jettison all of the... he has to jettison the argument once he becomes a Christian. You get what I'm saying? In other words, if the argument that brought me to conclude that God exists, and maybe even that the Bible is true, is an argument that presupposes billions of years, and if when I finally get to the Bible, I'm told that the universe is only thousands of years, I have to jettison the very reason why I actually came to believe the existence of God or the reliability of the Bible or something. And so the young earth creationist who uses this material has to use it in such a qualified manner that I think it becomes almost counterproductive. And I think that's what Ken Ham and other young earth creationists see, and that's why they don't even bother with it. They utilize... a very strictly what we would call a presuppositional approach to defending Scripture. Basically, they take Scripture as their starting point, and then they try to fit the evidence in that. I take what is called an approach that is integrative. I take both as a starting point, and I basically try to, sometimes the science makes me go back and reread the Bible, and sometimes the reading the Bible makes me go back and look again at the science. And look, let's take the whole issue of the beginning of the universe as an example. All of the great Christian theologians and all of the great Jewish theologians, for that matter, argued that the universe had an absolute origin. And that was true despite the fact that everybody was telling them they were wrong. And who was telling them? Big weights, big guys like Plato and Aristotle, and all of the people that followed in their train were saying that we live in a universe that is eternal. End of story. I mean, it's insane to say that the universe had an absolute origin, because out of nothing, nothing comes.
Naturally.
Right. So there you have it. So what else, you know, what else do you need? Well, the Bible clearly states that the universe had an absolute origin. Now, whether you can prove that philosophically or scientifically or whatever is another issue, but it does say that. And so what were Christians driven to do? They were driven to craft an apologetic that either assumed that for the sake of argument, to get people to think more along the lines of a biblical God existing. So the kind of God that Aquinas was presenting to people is the biblical God sans creation, sans an absolute origin of the universe. And then he would say, I take by faith in what the scriptures teach, that the, you know, the Bible says the universe, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The universe had an absolute origin. The only thing that is truly eternal is God himself. Or you would have people that followed someone like Bonaventura, who was a Franciscan monk, who adhered to the Kalam argument, and he would confront this objection of the pagans who said the universe is eternal. Now, both approaches, I think, are good, and that's why we've actually used both approaches. We've gone through the Thomistic route, and now we're looking at the route of Bonaventura. And if the argument is sound, it's sound, and we've proven this. But what my point is this: what did the Bible do? The Bible is so clear about the origin of the universe, the absolute origin of the universe, that it drove our intellectuals to seek out evidence in nature for it. And so this would be a case where the reading of the Bible affected the way we did science. Sometimes the opposite is the case. Sometimes you'll be out there and you'll discover something in science and you'll say, well, this contradicts my reading of the Bible. Then you go back and you look at the Bible more closely and you realize, oh, I read the Bible wrong. And this can get tricky.
Yeah,
this can get very tricky. But sometimes this happens. And I think the best example of that would be...
Flat Earth.
I'm thinking even more along the lines of Copernicus and his discovery that the Earth is not the center of the universe. Well, this is heliocentrism versus geocentrism. For millennia going on, the world was... It was a geocentric worldview. This was Ptolemy. This was Aristotle. This was, and there were texts in the Bible that people would go to vindicate this idea, like Joshua commanding the sun to stand still. That does seem to presuppose that the earth is standing still and the sun is moving. By the way, we now know that it's all moving, but
well, even the galaxy.
Yeah, everything's moving.
The thing is, it's the galaxy is hurling at a million miles an hour.
Sure.
Through the universe.
Sure.
So it seems like everything.
Everything is moving. Now, you read that text, and then you discover you have all these proofs that the Earth is actually going around the sun. Well, what do you do with a text like God has set the Earth on its foundation so that it doesn't move? What that forced Christians to do is that it forced them to look at the text more carefully. And without reading the science into it, although they did allow the science to make them reread it,
right. They
realized that, hey, we've been misreading the Bible.
And misinterpreting.
And we're misinterpreting it. Now, a lot of skeptics out there will say, oh, that's convenient. Every time science discovers something new, you go back and change the meaning of the text. Well, if that's what we're doing, then we should be condemned for it. My point is not that we should allow science to make us reinterpret the original meaning of the text. My point is that sometimes we miss the original meaning of the text.
Well, let me go back to the flat earth example for a second.
Yeah.
You know, for centuries, they believed that the earth was flat.
Sure.
That if you sailed out from Europe, you'd sail right off the edge of the world.
Sure.
But if they had read Job,
yeah,
they would see the world's being described as spheres.
Yeah.
And it was always there. So we haven't changed the Bible to fit the science. It was always there.
But the science inspired us to look at the Bible a second time.
Go back and look and say, you know, I don't think the Bible ever got it wrong. I think man got it wrong
from time to time. Yes, exactly. And I think this is an important point because, look, there are going to be occasions where we're just not going to be able to be in sync with what science is currently saying, what the consensus of scientists are saying. I can imagine on many occasions we're going to just be like, we can't go there because the Bible just clearly says this. I'll give you one example. If you believe that the Bible is inerrant, then you must believe that the human race started off with just two people. I mean, that's just... Now, the current scientific consensus is that that is impossible. So you either have to say...
Well, that's probably the first question a young person would ask.
Right. But you either have to say the current scientific consensus is wrong. Well, what's your evidence? You may not have evidence. And so you may find yourself in tension between you and the scientific consensus. Or you have to say that the Bible is not inerrant and the Bible got that wrong. Those are your options. Your option is not to say, let's look at the text another way and see if we can massage the text into teaching whatever is going on in the sciences that would deny the origin of the human race by two people. I mean, that's just, you can't do that. So honesty entails that there are going to be times where we brought up against the scientific consensus. For centuries, our fathers in the faith had a scientific consensus of sorts. The universe is eternal, and they wouldn't back down. They just stuck to their guns. And here we are, centuries later, having a vindication in the science that they were right. And so that should be an inspiration to us to, you know, stick by our guns. But if you can legitimately, after hearing about what science is saying, if you can legitimately go back to the text, look at it and honestly show that in the original language, in the context it was written, and so on and so forth, this other interpretation that fits the science is a plausible interpretation, maybe even more plausible than the alternatives, then you're not being this crass, anachronistic, pseudo-intellectual who's reading the science into the text. You're simply allowing science to allow you to look at the text, to give the text the benefit of a second glance. And I don't see anything dishonest about that, and I don't see why anybody else would.
Well, I think that's the difference in science and scientism, Travis. I think scientism seeks to disprove God.
Right.
Science. Science simply asks the question and looks for the answer.
Yes.
And to assume, and I'll tell you, I got this right out of there, that science can answer some of the questions about God doesn't mean that we have an answer all the questions.
Exactly.
And I think that's, again, the stumbling block that a lot of people have in getting to faith.
Sure.
They assume that science has all the answers, and, you know, clearly it doesn't.
Right.
Because they still can't tell us what caused the universe.
Exactly.
They can tell us how it happened, but they can't tell us who or why.
Right. I agree. So we're going to do the introduction to this, and we will then end. I say here that we think that the philosophical arguments for the beginning of the universe are sufficient to warrant this premise that we're defending, that the universe had a beginning. And so while the majority of non-theistic philosophers down through the ages have assumed that the universe is eternal, we feel that had they reflected on the philosophical arguments given here, many would have concluded that a beginningless past is impossible. But be that as it may, there is little doubt that the reason most are now convinced that the past is finite has more to do with scientific investigation than philosophical reflection. Indeed, a host of new scientific evidence has now confirmed our premise that the universe had a beginning. As Craig and Sinclair explained, prior to the 1920s, scientists had always assumed that the universe was stationary and eternal. Tremors of the impending earthquake would topple this traditional cosmology. Were first felt in 1917, when Albert Einstein made a cosmological application of his newly discovered gravitational theory, the general theory of relativity. In so doing, he assumed that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic and that it exists in a steady state with a constant mean mass density and a constant curvature of space. To his chagrin, however, he found that general relativity would not permit such a model of the universe unless he introduced into his gravitational field equations a certain fudge factor, lambda, in order to counterbalance the gravitational effect of matter and so ensure a static universe. Einstein's universe was balanced on a razor's edge, however, and the least perturbation, even the transport of matter from one part of the universe to another, would cause the universe either to implode or expand. By taking this feature of Einstein's model seriously, the Russian mathematician Alexander Friedman and the Belgian astronomer Georges Lemaître were able to formulate, independently in the 1920s, solutions to the field equations which predicted an expanding universe. In short, Einstein's general relativity theory, sans his cosmological constant, which he would later say was the biggest mistake of his career, predicted an expanding universe, the implications of this being deduced by Friedman and Lemaître. On this Friedman-Lemaître model, as time moves forward, the distances separating the matter of the universe become greater. It is important to appreciate that as a general relativity-based theory, the model does not describe the expansion of the material content of the universe into a pre-existing space or a pre-existing Newtonian space, but rather is the expansion of space itself. This, according to John Wheeler, marked a tremendous turning point in science. Of all the great predictions that science has ever made over the centuries, was there ever one greater than this to predict, and to predict correctly, and predict against all expectation, a phenomenon so fantastic as the expansion of the universe? So what happened in the theory of relativity? Einstein gave a mathematical equation. And in that mathematical equation, the expansion of the universe is predicted. There's no empirical observation of this whatsoever at this point. And so what does Einstein do? He's a pantheist. And he can't have a universe that is expanding, because if it's expanding, then that would imply an origin point. And so he throws in a fudge factor, his cosmological constant. And that constant was meant to keep the universe from expanding. And as I said, he will later say that that is the greatest blunder of his academic career. He admits this in the 1930s. So we must draw out the implications of an expanding universe. However, since this is not meant to be a terribly technical treatise on the Kalam argument, we will not follow Craig's and Sinclair's highly involved treatment of the issue, except to recommend to the reader their excellent essay on the subject. We have instead decided to follow the simpler, but no less profound exposition offered by the late Robert Jastrow. Robert Jastrow was an astronomer who had no religious axe to grind when writing about the origin of the universe. He had even gone so far as to say that his personal views on the question of God's existence are close to those of Darwin, who wrote, "My theology is a simple muddle. I cannot look at the universe as the result of blind chance, yet I see no evidence of beneficent design in the details." He then went on to demonstrate that five independent lines of evidence,
the motions of the galaxies, the discovery of the primordial fireball, the laws of thermodynamics, the abundance of helium in the universe, and the life story of stars point to one conclusion. All indicate that the universe had a beginning. And so what we're going to do starting next week is we're going to start working our way through these five independent lines of evidence that prove that the universe had a beginning. Or, if I may speak as a scientist, although I'm not one, these independent lines of evidence make the conclusion that the universe had a beginning highly probable. No scientist can ever know anything for certain, given his science, but they strongly suggest a beginning of the universe, and this is just how most people proceed. I will say in closing, or one of the last things I'll say here, is that Einstein's theory of relativity is important in this respect also because, as Hugh Ross has pointed out in his writings, it's been demonstrated to something like 14 points beyond the decimal point. So in other words, we're talking about something that has been so widely tested that some astronomers are thinking of calling relativity a law instead of just a theory. And that's how strongly evidenced it is. And so the very fact that we have this strongly evidenced theory that has as its core a prediction of the origin of the universe is an extremely strong argument in favor of the origin of the universe too. And this is where philosophy, science, and physics and math, they all kind of converge here in general relativity, because even though it's not an empirical proof, it is a piece of theoretical physics that has been tested beyond beyond reasonable doubt. And so we know that the general theory of relativity is true. And since we know that it's true, we know that we live in an expanding universe. And so it's sort of like, this is just what you have to deal with. And all of our empirical observations have just done nothing but confirm the expanding universe. And so we'll unpack that.
Gravity either, but
right. But anyways, we'll pick that up next week. And so thank you for coming.
Oh.